Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says that an agreement can be reached on the 2015 deal if other parties remove sanctions they imposed on the Islamic Republic. Iran's UN envoy says Israel's inhumane and apartheid practices against Palestinians constitute the most serious case of human rights violation in the world. And Saudi-led warplanes conduct new raids on various districts across Yemen's Sana'a province just a day after targeting the province's telecom infrastructure. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's president says an agreement could be reached on the 2015 deal if other parties remove sanctions they imposed on the Islamic Republic.
There are some whispers about the U.S. requesting to hold direct negotiations with Iran. If these requests are serious, what will be Iran's definitive stance?
These requests have been made not recently, but they have been made for a long time. Many of the countries that hold meetings with us sometimes carry messages that the Americans have requested direct talks. This is not limited to the present, but has existed for a long time even under the previous Iranian administrations. No direct talks have so far been held with the Americans. However, what is clear, as we have stated before and we state now, is that if the other sides are ready to remove the cruel sanctions imposed on the Iranian people, there is room for any kind of agreement.
Ebrahim Raisi says that Tehran will not tie all the country's affairs to ongoing talks in Vienna. Raisi says Iran is pursuing a double approach to U.S. sanctions, their neutralization and removal. According to the Iranian president, the impact of sanctions can also be nullified through boosting relations with Iran's neighbors, including Russia. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal with Tehran and reimposed sanctions against the country. An eighth round of talks is underway in the Austrian capital as part of efforts aimed at reviving the pact. Political commentator Daniel Lazar says America's role in the world economy is shrinking and that Iran can mitigate the effects of Washington sanctions through new allies.
Well, it can reach trade agreements and other kinds of agreements with other parties, outside powers like Russia and China. I mean, the U.S.'s role in the world economy is shrinking dramatically, and the U.S. is no longer the only major power on Earth. So therefore, Iran has other potential allies. It can diversify. It can reach agreements. And therefore, those could all have the effect of mitigating the economic impact of the U.S. foreign policy. I'm much more optimistic than I was a few weeks ago. And the reason I'm optimistic is that there was a report in the U.S. in the New York Times that the U.S. has dropped its demand that that Iran dramatically roll back its missile program and stop its other aspects of its foreign policy, its aid program to Hezbollah, the Houthis, etc. So the U.S. is showing more flexibility in returning and seeking to return to the JCPOA's original goal of simply controlling nuclear arms development in the Persian Gulf. And so that seems to be a big change on America's part. And so therefore it shows that America is willing to be flexible to a degree in pushing these negotiations forward. So therefore I'm more optimistic.
Israeli forces demolished several Palestinian homes in a Bedouin village in the Negev Desert. Now this is the 197th time Araqib village is razed to the ground. And with their makeshift homes destroyed, over 20 families living in the village are now exposed to the harsh conditions of the desert. The area has seen a spate of demonstrations against Israel's expansionist policies in recent weeks. Protesters are denouncing the regime's practices, which are aimed at seizing more Palestinian land. American activists are also signing a petition calling on U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to intervene and stop what they call the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the Negev Desert. Saudi warplanes carry out yet another set of attacks across Yemen's Sana'a province. Yemeni media said districts of Sanhan, Bani Matar, and Sabin have come under multiple attacks. Raids come a day after similar strikes on the province targeted a telecommunications tower. The Saudi-led coalition has ramped up bombings of the war-torn country in recent weeks. The Yemeni army has been responding to the attacks with cross-border strikes into Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. While people in Yemen have gathered near the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to protest the continued detention of 7 oil ships by Saudi Arabia, demonstrators have vowed to keep up their protests until the ships are released. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from the Yemeni capital.
Yemenis have staged a demonstration in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a to slam the Saudi Arabia's continued detention of 7 Yemeni oil ships. A number of health workers were also among the protesters.
Saudi Arabia is still holding 7 fuel ships, all of which have entry permits from the United Nations and have been inspected by UNVIM. However, unfortunately, these ships are pirated in international waters by American and Saudi warships. Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis in all provinces due to the ongoing blockade by Saudi Arabia. The health sector is the worst hit by this crisis, and this threatens the lives of millions, including children, who are bearing the brunt of Saudi war on Yemen.
The Ministry of Health said the healthcare system is on the verge of collapse, as many health facilities cannot provide medical services due to the ongoing Saudi blockade.
There is no doubt that the fuel ban affects all vital sectors, especially the health sector. All hospitals will be subject to shutdown due to the lack of electric power, including intensive care, emergency, blood banks, dialysis centers, oncology treatment centers, and many other departments. There is an inevitable catastrophe that will affect the health sector, which is exposing the lives of millions to the risk of death.
For years now, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh fuel shortage as the Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-wracked country in a desperate struggle to survive.
The protesters say the illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships is a clear violation of international law that prohibits all acts of piracy. They say it is a shame on the United Nations to turn a blind eye to the years-long blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies on Yemen.
Iraq's top court confirms the re-election of Mohammed al-Halbousi as Speaker of Parliament, paving the way now for the formation of a new government. Ruling also allows Parliament to resume sessions where a new president will be selected, who in turn will choose the next prime minister. The Supreme Court rejected appeals from 2 Parliament members who had demanded the annulment of Halbousi's re-election. They objected to the way the Parliament session was held when the Speaker was elected. Appeals came after a chaotic first meeting of Parliament. Rival political blocs remained divided over the October elections, with some parties questioning the electoral process. Lawmakers have until the 8th of February to elect a president. And now the second round of Italy's presidential election has produced the same verdict as that of the first round. As Max Cibilli reports, lawmakers, most of whom have cast blank ballots, are struggling to agree on a consensus candidate.
The political stalemate continues. On Tuesday, also a second round of voting to elect Italy's president of the republic proved inconclusive, with a vast majority of the 1,009 grand electors casting blank ballots, as they did in Monday's first round. Italian political parties have so far failed to find an agreement on a consensus candidate. Meetings between party leaders have continued behind the scenes, and although current Prime Minister Mario Draghi remains the most likely contender, a deal on the figure that unites the country is still far from being reached. Prime Minister Draghi is reportedly trying to persuade political leaders to support his candidacy as Italy's next president. However, a large number of lawmakers oppose this idea, fearing that if Draghi is elected head of state, it could lead to early elections.
We think that President Draghi have to stay at Palazzo Chigi and to continue to do the prime minister, because if President Draghi move to the Quirinale, it's really difficult to find another person like Draghi to continue the work in the government.
Also on Tuesday, the rightist alliance made up of the League, Brothers of Italy and Forza Italia proposed 3 possible presidential candidates. The League leader Matteo Salvini has repeatedly warned that if Draghi leaves the role of Prime Minister, the multi-party ruling coalition would likely split, raising the risk of snap elections.
Non siamo qui a imporre.
We are not here to impose anything on anybody. In the last 30 years, the president has always been named by centre-left parties. We hope the names we are proposing are received with a willingness to discuss them.
It is very unlikely that a new president will be elected before Thursday. A majority of two-thirds of the grand electors is needed to vote in a new head of state in the first three ballots from the fourth round. So as of Thursday, an absolute majority would be sufficient. Max Civili, Rome.
A U.S. plane carrying another shipment of military equipment and munitions has landed in Ukraine amid heightened tensions between the West and Russia. Ukrainian defense minister says this is a third batch of U.S. weapons arriving in the capital, Kiev, and it's part of a $200 million security package pledged by Washington to Ukraine. Several NATO members such as Britain, Spain, Denmark, and the Netherlands have already sent consignments of weapons and warships to the region amid tensions with Russia over Ukraine. The West is accusing Moscow of intending to invade Ukraine by massing troops along its border. Russia denies the claim and says the move is strictly defensive amid its concerns over NATO's eastward expansion and military activities near its borders. Political analyst Markus Papadopoulos believes that the U.S. and its Western allies want to maintain their influence on Ukraine.
Whilst Washington will not go to war with Russia over Ukraine, nonetheless, the Americans are hoping that by increasing the supply of weapons to the Ukrainian armed forces, this will deter Russia from taking military action in Ukraine, which will mean that America's foothold in the country will be preserved. Because we must not forget that ever since the American engineered coup in Kiev in February of 2014 against the democratically elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, which saw him replaced by a pro-Western and fervently anti-Russian government, Ukraine has been in the West's sphere of influence, politically, economically, culturally, and militarily. So that is why the Americans, together with the British, are rapidly increasing the amount of weaponry which they are sending to Ukraine. They are doing so to preserve, to defend, to maintain their foothold in Ukraine.
The euro falls to a one-month low amid fears of a new conflict in Europe over Ukraine. Euro was down more than 0.2% on Tuesday, whereas the dollar index gained nearly 0.1%. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund warns that a conflict between Russia and Ukraine will probably send energy costs and consumer prices higher. This, in turn, could keep inflation rates high for a longer period of time. At a time of record inflation and soaring energy costs, jobless are fighting to be heard in France's presidential election campaign. Top charities have compiled a report which prioritizes the ideas and experiences of the unemployed. Rami Mazahiri has more out of Paris.
France is starting their election season, but the issue of purchasing power has pushed a much longer-running problem out of the campaign, unemployment. France's army of unemployed were the first social group to be hurt by the coronavirus lockdowns, and they'll be the last to enjoy the recovery. The nation's top religious charities compiled a report, The Words of the Unemployed, to show the cruelty of adding harsh social judgments to economic and personal distress.
To suddenly find oneself without a job is to suddenly find yourself quite isolated. The lack of regular social contact makes immediate impact, and it's difficult to find one's inner dynamism again. The COVID lockdowns have made isolation for the unemployed even more total, as interviews are conducted only over the internet or on the telephone. And this can be even more discouraging and anxiety-provoking for job seekers.
The report and the unemployed strongly encourage spending tax money and time on collectives, associations, and social groupings, which give the jobless a place for regular human contact, discussions, and the chance to work with people again on worthwhile projects.
A whopping 60% of the unemployed say their biggest obstacle in returning to the workforce is a lack of decent jobs. They report scores of competitors for every single job opening in their field. It's a complaint of frustration which has been heard often ever since the age of austerity started.
Since 2008, French unemployment has risen over 30%. Today, top French economists put the real unemployment rate at over 20%, as part-time work has exploded in a country where it used to be almost non-existent.
My real-world job experiences too often get minimized by employers because I have periods of part-time work in my profession, or because I've had to work outside my field only occasionally, and I don't understand that point of view. What's vital for unemployed people is to have state job center counselors who aren't burdened with too many cases and who can give unemployed people time and attention. Counselors need to learn about the industry or field the person wants to work in to find them a proper long-term solution.
The unemployed say they aren't listened to, but talked down to, typified by President Emmanuel Macron's 2018 instructions to an actual job seeker that he could merely cross the street and find a job. In almost 5 years, Macron's neoliberal revolution has provoked massively repressed social protests that only barely reduced unemployment from its all-time high in 2017 of 6.3 million people. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
A severe winter storm sweeps through the Greek capital Athens, leaving scores of people trapped in their vehicles and stranded on roads. More than 1,800 vehicles are said to be stuck now on motorways. Soldiers and firefighters have been deployed to try to rescue these people. Many regions in Athens are also hit by power outages. The rare storm named Elpida has also forced authorities to declare Tuesday and Wednesday a public holiday, keeping only a few businesses open. Prime Minister Kyriakou Mitsotakis has been heavily criticized for his poor handling of the situation. The government, however, puts the blame on the motorways management company for its failure to maintain normal traffic conditions. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. U.S. Republican Senator Mitt Romney, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, and others recently helped kill off a voting rights bill that Democrats claim is essential to protecting democracy from a Trump-driven onslaught. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republican Resistance to Trump Rings Hollow as So-Called Moderates Say No on Voting Rights. U.S. Senator Mitt Romney, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, and others were hailed as the so-called conscience of the Republican Party. But their deeds in the Senate have provoked accusations of hypocrisy. They have been hailed as the purported heroes of the resistance to former U.S. President Donald Trump's hostile takeover. But Senator Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney, and others recently helped kill off a voting rights bill that Democrats claim is essential to protecting democracy from a Trump-driven onslaught. The blanket opposition from these Republicans is provoking criticism that their rejection of the ex-president rings hollow, and despite their words, they are ultimately helping further his authoritarian agenda. Natasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, said, "They might not like Trump, but they have the character of Trump. The reason why Trump was able to lead their party is because he claimed that he is a good representation. He's a liar. They lie. They've decided to use any means necessary to maintain power. If that means political corruption, they decide that they're going to go that route." Black Voters Matter and other groups warn the Republican-led states across the country are passing laws making it more difficult for African Americans and others to vote by consolidating polling locations, requiring certain types of identification, and ordering other changes. In response, Democrats in the House of Representatives recently passed the Freedom to Vote, John R. Lewis Act, which would make Election Day a national holiday, ensure access to early voting and mail-in ballots, and enable the Justice Department to intervene in states with a history of voter interference. The legislation was also supported by all 50 Democrats in the Senate, but collapsed in recent days when Republicans used a procedural rule known as the filibuster to block it in the evenly divided chamber. Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, then called on a vote on changing Senate rules to allow the chamber to pass the bill by a simple majority vote. Again, all Republicans were opposed, and now they were joined by Democrats Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, ensuring a 52-48 defeat. It was a bitter defeat for President Joe Biden just hours after he held a marathon press conference on Wednesday, 19th of January, marking the end of his first year in office. The president said in a statement, "I am profoundly disappointed." Much liberal fury was focused on Democratic holdouts Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but their intransigence only mattered because all the Republicans, including so-called moderates, stood firm against legislation that aims to combat voter suppression, which largely impacts communities of color, even those who claim to be fiercely anti-Trump. Mitt Romney, a former presidential nominee, is a prime example. He was the only senator to break with his party by voting to convict Donald Trump for abuse of power in his first impeachment trial in 2020. He was then one of seven Republicans to find Donald Trump guilty of incitement of insurrection at his second impeachment trial last year. Yet, by then, Romney, senator for Utah, had already spelled out his opposition to the voting rights legislation, dismissing it as a partisan takeover of federal elections and even comparing it to Trump's false claim of election rigging in 2020. Mitt Romney was not alone. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, who also voted to convict Donald Trump at last year's impeachment trial, described the push to defend voting rights as a charade to satisfy a minority addicted to rage on Twitter, adding, "It's bad for America. It's just as undermining of public trust in elections as what Donald Trump did last year." Senators Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman, and Tim Scott, all of whom have spoke out against Donald Trump at various times, opposed the bill. In the earlier House vote, Never Trumpers Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger also towed the the party line. Liz Cheney, Vice Chairwoman of the House Select Committee investigating the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, has earned bipartisan admiration from some unlikely quarters. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman even floated the idea of her becoming Joe Biden's running mate in the 2024 election. But the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney made clear last year she did not see connection between Trump's big lie about 2020 and the blitz of voter restrictions imposed by Republican state legislatures. Liz Cheney told Axios website, "For example, I will never understand the resistance to voter ID." Some commentators agree that there is nothing inconsistent about decrying Trump's assault on democracy and rejecting Democrats' sweeping proposals. Michael Steele, the first African-American to serve as chairman of the Republican National Committee, said, "You can be against Donald Trump and have a policy view on voting rights. I would personally maybe disagree with it. That would not lead them to support the proposed legislation in the House or the Senate." But some conservative critics of Donald Trump admit that the reforms, which they regard as an example of government overreach at the expense of states' autonomy, even though Article 1 of the Constitution explicitly authorizes Congress to set federal election rules, put them in a quandary. Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman from Illinois, said, "I'm vehemently anti-Trump, but anti what the Democrats are trying to do at the federal level. So I'd be in the same grouping. Republicans are doing a bunch of work with little value, but the answer to that, in my mind, is not bad, unconstitutional federal legislation." But Joe Walsh objects to Mitt Romney's attempt to equate Donald Trump's lies with Joe Biden's policy. Joe Walsh said, "I disagree with Mitt Romney and any other Republican that's making any sort of comparisons between what Trump did to our elections and what Democrats are doing." The recent vote was also the latest marker of the Republican Party's transformation in the Trump era. 16 of its current senators voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act in 2006, but opposed the latest bill, which would update the most powerful part of the law. Republican presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush all supported its renewal. Antoine Seawright, a senior advisor to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, took issue with Mitt Romney and colleagues' claim that Republicans are not making it harder for minorities to vote. Antoine Seawright said, "It's intellectually dishonest for anyone to say that there's not an effort to suppress, suffocate, and silence the votes of black people, in particular around this country. All you have to do is look at the bills that have been filed and where they have been filed. With the voting rights measures aimed at safeguarding democracy now apparently dead in the water, it may be harder for independents, liberals, and others to heap praise on anti-Trump Republicans in quite the same way as before." Kurt Bardella, an advisor to the Democratic National Committee, argues that doing the right thing once does not make them heroes, adding, "Just because you're anti-Trump doesn't mean you're still not part of the anti-democratic effort that's being spearheaded by the Republican Party in America." Kurt Bardella, a former senior advisor to Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, added, "For Republicans like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, it says everything that they're still willing to be called Republicans, and it is the Republican Party's position to make it harder for minorities in America to vote. You look at the closing of voting locations in states like Georgia, where locations that have the highest density of minority voters are now having less options to go vote. Kurt Bardella concluded by saying, "That's pretty straightforward. That's pretty racist. It demonstrates the white privilege in play for people like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney to not see that. The reality is, if they're not willing to move forward and assist in the effort to enact voter protections in America, then they're Donald Trump's biggest ally."
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest, Sayyid Muhsin Naqwi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is a very relevant one and also perhaps a political one. And depending on the way you answer this, dear Sayyid, it can either create disunity or unity among Muslims. So inshallah you are prepared for this question. And the question, it is as follows, dear Sayyid. Doesn't preaching about the circumstances and events related to the martyrdom of the Lady of the Woman of the World, Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam, create division and also leads to disunity in the Islamic Ummah? If so, and how are we then supposed to talk or preach about this issue?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, the question is wrong. Why? Because the Lady Fatima salamullah alayha is the daughter of the Prophet. She is Sayyidatun Nisa'il Alameen, as you mentioned. She is the master of the old ladies of the world. And on top of that, we have many narrations in regards to this personality that the Prophet has given a lot of emphasis to this personality. Also, we know that the verse, which is known as Ayat Tathir, the verse of purification, was revealed for her and her households.
Right.
And apart from that, we have Ayatul Mawadda, the verse of love, loving Ahlul Bayt,
right,
is the reward of what have Prophet have done for the Muslim Ummah. So when we look at this context, obviously Lady Fatima becomes a very important personality of Islam.
A central figure, perhaps,
yes,
also.
And even we have many narrations. Even Aisha has said that I haven't seen anyone afsahu min al-Fatima, like who is more eloquent than Fatima, or the most, we can say, like the most pious or God-weary. She has used the word atqa, or like for the abid as well, a'badu, for example. Like there are different terminologies. And she has used, like in these narrations, she has used the superlative form of these words, that she hasn't seen anyone who is more closer, more, we can say, like similar to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So when we have such narrations, and on top of the verses, therefore, it shows the importance of this personality.
Right.
Now, reading the life of this personality is necessary for every Muslim, so that we can see how the deviations were occurred in the Islam, within Islam, where we went wrong. Obviously, you know, the history is to learn lessons. It's not to tease anyone. Unfortunately, right, unfortunately, we have left the educational perspective of the history, and we have attached to the history with our, we can say like...
Biases,
or, you know, we look at the history with our emotions, through emotions. So we try to look at the history with the emotional factor, whereas the history is being said for educational purposes.
We should have an objective perspective.
Yes, it is narrated to learn some lessons out of it. Therefore, when we look at the history, when we look at such a personality and what happened to her, like in her life, we need to learn some lessons that a lady who is the daughter of the Prophet, who has been known as the mother of the Prophet, Umm Abiha, the Prophet has said that you are the mother of your father, who is the mother of two imams who are the masters of the men of the heaven. They're Sayyida Shababi Ahlil Jannah. Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, her two sons, they are the master of all men of the paradise. So basically, they are the masters of the paradise.
Right.
So when we look at this, when we look at such a personality, obviously, we need to follow her footsteps. Following footsteps is only in a way when we narrate what happened, how she lived, and obviously the incidents that happened at the end of her, like, you know, life, the last time, like age. So narrating all these things are not the cause of deviation. It is not the cause of, we can say, some kind of deviation within the Islamic world or teasing someone. It is not the purpose. The purpose is to make clear that when there is such a lady, what happened to her, and what should we not do in order to repeat all those things.
So the logic here in narrating these events and looking at her life biography, in short, is what you were hinting at. We should look at her life biography, is such to state the facts and not to come with opinions
and learn the lessons. Political. Yes,
right. And just to state the facts and learn from it.
Obviously, we need to learn because these are the role models. A role model is a role model when we can learn something out of it, when we can take lessons out of it. And the best thing about the role model, like especially the Islamic role models that we have, they do not have any expiry date. They're not specific to a specific time.
Islam is universal, never ending.
Islam is universal, especially those who are made role model by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, the prophets, saints, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, these are introduced by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
So these are connected to the divine entity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So anything which is connected to Allah, it becomes divine.
Right, so of course.
These personalities are also divine.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And on top of that, we all believe on Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We Shias believe that he's been born and he's alive. He's around 1,200 years old. But in the Ahl Sunnah, they believe that he will be born.
He's not
but
born yet.
Obviously, according to our narrations that we have from Imam Mahdi, he said, "Fi bint Rasulillah li uswatun hasana." In the life of the Lady Fatima or the daughter of the Prophet, is a role model for me.
Sayyid, it is true that there is a role model, but you, of course, yourself know inevitably whenever you talk about this subject, feelings, emotions get involved, political agendas get involved. It always creates disunity. How are we supposed to preach or talk about this subject whenever we try to talk about it, we are faced with opposition and inevitably we unfortunately create disunity?
Well, obviously, we need to go on the common grounds. We need to talk on the common grounds. Ahlul Bayt are the common grounds.
Right.
Because, why? Because in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that, لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَةِ. Do not ask, O Prophet, do not ask for any reward, but except loving the Ahlul Bayt. So the Lady Fatima or the Ahlul Bayt are the point of, are the common, we can say, grounds to talk.
Right.
On the other hand, if someone has some affection towards any personality, but obviously we need to think that if there is something wrong, that is wrong. Right. We should have this capability of accepting or admiring the wrong things that has happened or wrong policies that have been taken in the history by some people. Maybe we love them, but obviously we need to accept it. This is being open-minded. You know, that's why I said we look at the history through our emotions. Yeah. And this emotional factor blinds us and does not allow us to look at the faults and the advantages, like the good things and the bad deeds of a person.
We are not objective, we are just subjective.
Yes.
Right.
So basically, if there is a personality who has been loved by most of the Ahl Sunnah, that is fine, because they have chosen them as their leaders and they're following their footsteps. But on the other hand, we should accept that if they have committed some kind of mistakes in their life,
right,
obviously they're not infallible. They are fallibles.
Right.
The only infallibles are the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, about whom Allah said that we have taken away all the impurifications from you. It is the
Ayat-ut-Tahir.
So the other leaders who's been followed by the Ahl Sunnah or other Muslims, if they are fallible, we should accept this. We should not attach infallibility with them. That is the wrong path. That is the mistake which commonly the Muslim Ummah is doing. The people, they do mistake over here, and that's why they say it's the cause of deviation. It is not the cause of deviation. It's the mentality which you have chosen.
Right.
Obviously, Allah Subhanahu wa Taala has given us the intellect, and we need to think about these scenarios or the history through the aql or intellect. And intellect says that if a person is fallible, you should consider him as fallible, and there might be some mistakes which have been done.
Mistakes are normal.
Yes,
it's human
but
nature.
You should not take those mistakes on your own self.
Right.
It's something which has been done by them. We can simply just answer, yes, the policy was wrong. We think this was wrong, and it shouldn't be happened with the Lady Fatima. They shouldn't do such and such things. Those incidents shouldn't be happened. But obviously, they have done it in their time, so they are answerable to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the simplest answer.
Right.
But because we follow them, therefore we need to follow their footsteps. And we follow the route of, or the path of school of Khilafah, for example.
Right. But I say, just on a final question, we as Shia Muslims, should we preach about this, or should we just preach for ourselves but not tell others about these events?
Now, obviously, we need to make aware the whole Muslim Ummah. This is our duty, obviously. This is the duty, that you talk about the truth. So we need to deliver the truth, but in a way that when we look that there are specific people who are getting been hurted because of these things, you can like be careful, like in front of them, don't talk that openly.
Right. Yet.
But on the other side, we need to tell our generations what happened in the history, and that is the right of every Muslim to know about the history.
And on that note, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your insightful knowledge. Okay. And also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
We are with you.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Facebook's involvement in the Zionist regime's efforts aimed at silencing Palestinian online voices that call for justice, freedom, and end of the occupation is itself situated in an agreement the company had reached with the regime in September 2016, says Ramzi Baru, journalist and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle, in an article published under the heading, How the Zionist Regime's Facebook Law Plans to Control All Palestinian Content Online. Stay tuned for more. It is ironic that even former right-wing Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had rejected a Knesset bill which proposed to give the regime greater power to control and suppress online content. This was in 2016. The bill was introduced by Netanyahu's Likud party rival, Gideon Saar. Some analysts argued that Netanyahu had feared that a law aimed at suppressing Palestinian freedom of speech online could be exploited by his enemies to control his own speech and incitement. Now that Netanyahu is no longer in the picture, the bill is back, and so is Saar. Gideon Saar is currently the Zionist regime's so-called justice minister and deputy prime minister. While his boss, Naftali Bennett, is moving rapidly to expand settlements and to worsen already horrific realities for Palestinians on the ground, Saar is expanding the Zionist regime's military occupation of Palestinians to the digital realm. What is known as the Facebook Law is set to grant the Zionist regime courts the power to demand the removal of user-generated content on social media content platforms that can be perceived as inflammatory or as harming the security of the regime, or the security of people, or the security of the public. According to a December 30 statement by the Palestinian Digital Rights Coalition, PDRC, and the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council, PHROC, The Zionist regime's censorship of Palestinian content online has deepened since 2016, when SARS bill was first introduced. In their statement, the two organizations highlighted the fact that the Zionist regime's so-called cyber unit had submitted 2,421 requests to social media companies to delete Palestinian content in 2016. That number has grown exponentially since, to the extent that the cyber unit alone has requested the removal of more than 20,000 Palestinian items. PDRC and PHROC suggest that the new legislation, which was already approved by the Ministerial Committee for Legislation on December 27th, would only strengthen the relationship between the cyber unit and social media companies. Unfortunately, that relationship is already strong, at least with Facebook, which routinely censors Palestinian content and has been heavily criticized by Human Rights Watch and other organizations. After examining the numerous allegations of Facebook censorship, Deborah Brown, the senior digital rights researcher and advocate at HRW, concluded that Facebook has suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues in Palestine. Facebook's involvement in the Zionist regime's efforts aimed at silencing Palestinian online voices that call for justice, freedom, and end of the occupation is itself situated in an agreement that the company had reached with the Zionist regime in September 2016. Then the Zionist regime announced that it had signed an agreement with the social media giant to work together to determine how to tackle incitement on the social media network. Within days, the accounts of prominent Palestinian journalists and activists were reportedly being deleted. The Zionist regime's latest Facebook law does not just pertain to controlling content on Facebook-related platforms, including Instagram and others. According to a Haaretz editorial published on December 29th, the impact of this particular bill is far-reaching, as it will grant district court judges throughout the country the power to remove posts not only from Facebook and other social media outlets, but from any website at all. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime's censorship of Palestinian content is justified under the typical pretense of protecting the Zionist regime's national security. We all know how the Zionist regime interprets this elusive concept to include anything from a Palestinian calling for the Zionist regime to be held accountable for its crimes in the occupied territories to another demanding the end of the Israeli apartheid to a third writing a poem. A case in point was the humiliating imprisonment of Palestinian poet Darin Tatur. The latter, an Israeli citizen, was thrown in jail in 2015 per court order for writing a short poem entitled "Resist My People, Resist Them." Judging from past experience, undoubtedly, the Facebook law would almost exclusively target Palestinians. Moreover, judging from the Zionist regime's previous successes, many digital and social media companies would comply with the Zionist regime's demands of censoring Palestinians everywhere. In January 11th report, the Arab Center for Social Media Advancement, Hamle, detailed some of the practices that the Zionist regime engages in to monitor, silence, and spy on Palestinians. Hamle's report, entitled #Palestine2021, discusses the increased use of surveillance technologies, especially in the context of a proposed Zionist regime law that would expand the use of facial recognition cameras in public spaces. It is worth noting that such technologies have already been used against Palestinians at the Zionist regime's military checkpoints throughout the West Bank for at least 2 years. Moreover, the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware, which has recently made headlines throughout the world for its use against numerous high-profile figures, has also long been used against Palestinian activists. In other words, Palestine continues to be the testing ground for the Zionist regime's violations of all kinds, whether in new weaponry, crowd control, or surveillance. Expectedly, what applies to Palestinians demanding their freedom online does not apply to Israelis inciting violence and spreading hatred against those very Palestinians. According to the Hamle Index of Racism and Incitement, published last June, during the Zionist regime's war on the besieged Gaza Strip and the subsequent anti-Palestinian violence throughout Palestine in May 2021, incitement in Hebrew against Arabs and Palestinians increased by 15 times if compared to the same period of the last year. Much of this has gone unnoticed, and it is hardly the subject of the proposed Facebook law or the sinister activities of the cyber unit. For Gideon Sa'ar and his ilk, anti-Palestinian incitement, along with the daily violence meted out against the occupied Palestinians, is a non-issue. While the Zionist regime is permitted, thanks to the deafening silence of the international community, to maintain its military occupation of Palestine, to cement its apartheid, and to deepen its control of Palestinian life everywhere, it should not be permitted to expand this matrix of control to the digital realm as well. Civil society organizations, activists, and ordinary people everywhere must speak out to bring an end to this mockery. Moreover, as the Pegasus and the facial recognition surveillance technologies experiences have taught us, what is usually first applied to Palestinians is eventually normalized and applied everywhere else. The Zionist regime should therefore be confronted in its abuses of human rights in Palestine, because these abuses, if normalized, will become a part of our daily lives regardless of where we are in the world.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.